self. So now I'm a chaperone. Mademoiselle Gillenormand kissed him.
You're not one to get up to that sort of mischief, Théodule. You follow discipline. You're a slave to orders. You're a man of scruple and duty. You'd never leave your family in the lurch to go gallivanting about with some shameless creature.
The Lancer gave the complacent grin of a pickpocket praised for his probity. Cartouche revered. On the evening that followed this tête-à-tête, Marius hopped up on the coach without suspecting that he was under surveillance. As for the detective, the first thing he did was fall asleep. His sleep was sound and conscientious. Argus snored all night. At daybreak, the coach driver cried out,
"Vernon! Vernon relay next stop! Passengers for Vernon!"
And Lieutenant Théodule woke up.
"Right," he mumbled, still half asleep. "This is where I get off."
Then his memory gradually unfogged, an effect of waking up, and he thought of his aunt, the 10 louis, and the account he had agreed to give of Marius's comings and goings. It made him laugh. "Maybe he's not on the coach anymore," he thought, as he buttoned up his uniform jacket. He might have stopped at Poissy. He might have stopped at Truyel if he didn't get out at Moulin. He might have got out at Mantes, unless he got out at Rolboise, or unless he pushed on to Passy, where you can either head left toward Evreux or right toward La Roche-Guyon.
"You run after him, Auntie. What the hell am I going to write to her, the dear old thing?"
At that moment a pair of black trousers clambered down from the top deck and appeared at the coach window.
Could that be Marius?
The lieutenant wondered. It was Marius. A little peasant girl at the back of the car, mixed up among the horses and the postillions, was offering flowers to the travellers.
"Give your ladies flowers," she cried.
Marius approached her and bought the most beautiful flowers on her tray.
"Now that," said Théodule, jumping down from the car, "has got me going. Who the hell is he going to take those flowers to? It'd take a damned pretty woman for such a beautiful bouquet. I'd like to see that one."
And so, no longer by proxy now, but out of personal curiosity, like a dog hunting on its own behalf, he began to trail Marius. Marius paid no attention whatsoever to Théodule. Some elegant women got down from the coach, but he did not even give them a glance. He seemed not to see anything around him.
"He's in love. And how?" thought Théodule.
Marius headed for the church.
"This gets better," Théodule said to himself. "The church, of course. Nothing like spicing up a rendezvous with a bit of a mass. What could be more exquisite than eyeing someone over the good Lord?"
Marius reached the church, but did not go in. Instead, he turned and went behind the chevet. He disappeared around the corner of one of the buttresses of the apse.
"The rendezvous must be outside, in the open," said Théodule. "Let's see the girl."
And he advanced on the tips of his boots toward the corner Marius had turned. When he reached it, he was flummoxed. Marius was kneeling in the grass, over a grave, with his head in both hands. He had scattered his bouquet over it. At the far end of the grave, at a bulge that marked the head, there was a black wooden cross with this name in white letters: Colonel Baron Pontmercy. You could hear Marius sobbing. The girl was a grave. Marble versus Granite. This was where Marius had come the first time he had absented himself from Paris. This was where he returned each time Monsieur Gillenormand said he's sleeping away from home. Lieutenant Théodule was absolutely floored by this unexpectedly close contact with the sepulchre. He experienced an unpleasant and odd sensation that he was incapable of analyzing, which had to do with respect for a grave combined with respect for a colonel. He backed away, leaving Marius alone in the cemetery, and there was something that smacked of military discipline in this backtracking. Death appeared to him without size epaulets, and he almost gave it a military salute. Not knowing what to write to his aunt, he opted to write nothing at all. And perhaps nothing would have come of the discovery made by Théodule about Marius's love life if, through one of those mysterious coincidences that so frequently happen, the scene in Vernon had not had a sort of repercussion almost immediately in Paris. Marius returned from Vernon early in the morning on the third day, got out at his grandfather's, and, weary after two nights spent in the coach, and feeling the need to make up for his lack of sleep by an hour at the swimming school, ran up to his room, took only enough time to remove his traveling coat and the black ribbon round his neck, and went off to the baths. Monsieur Gillenormand had risen early, like all old men in the pink of health, and had heard him come in and had rushed as fast as his old pins would carry him upstairs to the rooftop landing where Marius's room was, to give him a hug and ask him a few questions while he was at it, in the hope of finding out a bit more about where he'd been. But the young man had taken less time to go down than the octogenarian to climb up, and when old man Gillenormand stepped into the attic room, Marius was no longer there. The bed had not been slept in, and on the bed were laid out, trustingly, the coat and the black ribbon.
"I prefer that," said Monsieur Gillenormand.
And a moment later he made his entrance into the drawing-room, where Mademoiselle Gillenormand the elder was already in position, embroidering her cabriolet wheels. His entrance was triumphant. Monsieur Gillenormand held the coat in one hand and the neck ribbon in the other, and he cried,
"Victory! We are about to penetrate the mystery. We are going to find out how the story ends. We are going to put the finger on our sly little friend's debauchery. We're cutting straight to the romance. I have the portrait."
Indeed, a black shagreen locket, similar to a medallion, was hanging from the ribbon. The old man grabbed this locket and studied it for a while, without opening it, with the greedy, ravished, angry eyes of a poor, starving wretch eyeing a sumptuous meal not meant for him as it passes under his nose.
"For obviously this is a portrait. I know what I'm talking about. It's worn tenderly over the heart. What dunderheads they are! Some ugly tart that'd make you shudder, I'll warrant. Young men have such bad taste these days."
"Let's see, father," said the old maid. The locket opened when you pressed a spring. All they found in it was a piece of paper, folded.
"The same old story," Monsieur Gillenormand said, bursting out laughing. "I know what this is. It's a love letter."
"Ah, let's read it, then," said the aunt.
And she put her spectacles on. They unfolded the note and read the following. "For my son, the Emperor made me a baron on the battlefield of Waterloo. Since the Restoration contests this title, which I have paid for with my blood, my son will take it and bear it. It goes without saying that he will be worthy of it." What the father and daughter felt, words can never tell. They felt themselves chilled to the marrow by the breath of a death's head. They did not exchange a word. Only Monsieur Gillenormand said in a low voice, as though talking to himself,
"It's that swashbuckler's writing."
The aunt examined the note, turned it over and around, then put it back in the locket. At the same moment a tiny oblong parcel wrapped in blue paper fell from a coat pocket. Mademoiselle Gillenormand picked it up and undid the blue paper. It was Marius's set of 100 calling cards. She passed one to Monsieur Gillenormand, who read,
"Baron Marius Pontmercy."
The old man rang. Nicolette came. Monsieur Gillenormand took the ribbon, the locket, and the coat, threw the lot into the middle of the room, and said,
"Take this trash away."
A good hour passed in the deepest silence. The old man and the old maid were sitting with their backs to each other and were probably thinking, each on their own, the same things. At the end of the hour, Aunt Gillenormand said,
"Lovely."
A few minutes later, Marius appeared. He came in through the front door. Before he had even put a foot in the door of the drawing-room, he saw his grandfather, who was holding one of his calling cards in his hand, and who, on seeing him,
cried out with his crushing air of sneering bourgeois superiority, "Well, well, 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 you are a baron now? I present you with my compliments. What does this mean?"
Marius went slightly red and replied, "It means that I'm my father's son." Monsieur Gillenormand stopped laughing and said in a harsh voice,
"Your father? I am your father."
"My father,"
Marius went on, his eyes downcast and his manner stern, "was a humble and heroic man who served the Republic and France gloriously, who was great in the greatest history that men have ever made, who lived for a quarter of a century in a camp under cannon fire and musket fire during the day, at night in snow, in mud, in rain, who captured 2 standards, who received 20 wounds, who died forgotten and abandoned, and who only ever did 1 thing wrong, which was to love 2 ungrateful wretches too much, his country and me."
This was more than Monsieur Gillenormand could bear to hear. At that word, Republic, he had got to his feet, or rather, shot to his feet. Every one of the words that Marius had just uttered had inflicted on the face of the old royalist the effect of blasts of forge bellows on a burning brand. He went from black to red, from red to purple, and from purple to a dangerous flare.
"Marius," he yelled, "you abominable child! I don't know what your father was. I don't want to know. I don't know anything about him, and I don't know him. But what I do know is that there has never been anything but miserable bastards among all those sorts of scum. They are all, every one of them, rogues, cutthroats, redcaps, thieves. Every one of them, I tell you. Every one of them, I tell you. I don't know anyone. I say every one of them. You hear me, Marius? Don't you see? You're as much a baron as my slipper. They were all bandits who worked for Robespierre, doing his dirty work, all the brigands who served Buonaparte, all traitors who betrayed their legitimate king, all cowards who ran away from the Prussians and from the English at Waterloo. There you have what I know. If Monsieur your father is among them, I don't know. I'm sorry. Too bad. I am your servant."
It was Marius's turn to be the brand and Monsieur Gillenormand the bellows. Marius was shaking all over. He did not know where to look. His head was on fire. He was the priest who sees all his hosts thrown to the wind, the fakir who sees some passer-by spit on his idol. Such things could not be said with impunity in front of him, but what could he do? His father had just been trampled underfoot and stamped on in his presence, but by whom? By his grandfather. How could he avenge one without outraging the other? He couldn't possibly insult his grandfather, and it was equally impossible not to stand up for his father. On the one hand, a sacred tomb, on the other, white hair. For a moment or two he stood, drunk and tottering, with this whirlwind swirling around in his head. Then he looked up, stared hard at his grandfather, and shouted in a thundering voice, "Down with the Bourbons, and that fat pig of a Louis XVIII!" Louis XVIII had been dead 4 years. But he didn't care. The old man, red as a beetroot as he was, suddenly went whiter than his hair. He turned toward a bust of the Duc de Berry on the mantelpiece and bowed deeply to it with a sort of singular majesty. Then he strode twice, slowly and in silence, from the fireplace to the window, and from the window to the fireplace, crossing the whole length of the room, causing the parquet to creak like a stone statue on the move. The second time he bent over his daughter, who was bearing up under this shock with the stupor of an old sheep, and said to her with an almost calm smile, "A baron like Monsieur and a bourgeois like me cannot remain under the same roof." And suddenly, standing erect again, one, trembling, terrible, his forehead swelling with the frightening radiance of anger, he stretched his arm toward Marius and shouted, "Get out!" Marius left the house. The next day, Monsieur Gillenormand said to his daughter, "You will send that bloodsucker 60 pistoles every 6 months, and never speak to me of him again." Having an immense reserve of fury to vent, and not knowing what to do with it, he continued to address his daughter coldly as "vous" for over 3 months. Marius, for his part, had stormed out in outrage. One circumstance, we must mention, further aggravated his exasperation. Such piddling coincidences always complicate domestic dramas. Grievances are intensified by them, even though, in reality, they don't make anything any worse. In swiftly carting Malleus's trash to his room on his grandfather's orders, Nicolette had, without realizing, dropped the medallion of black shagreen with the note written by the colonel in it, probably on the attic stairs, which were in darkness. Neither this note nor the medallion could ever be found. Malleus was convinced that Monsieur Gillenormand, from that day forth he never called him anything else, had thrown his father's will into the fire. He knew by heart the few lines the colonel had written, and, consequently, nothing was lost. But the piece of paper itself, the handwriting, that sacred relic, all this was his heart itself. What had they done with it? Marius had gone away without saying where he was going, without knowing where he was going, with nothing but 30 francs, his watch, and a few rags in an overnight bag. He had climbed up into a cabriolet parked at the cab stand, had rented it by the hour, and set out willy-nilly for the Quartier Latin. What was to become of Marius? Book 4. Friends of the ABC. A group that nearly became history. In those days, outwardly so oblivious, a certain revolutionary frisson was vaguely felt around the place. Gusts of hot air rose up from the depths of 89 and 91 and floated about. The young were in the process of shedding their skins, if you'll forgive the expression. People were transformed, almost without suspecting it, by the very movement of time. The hands that march over the dial are also busy marching inside people's souls. Everyone took the step forward that they had to take. The royalists became liberals. The liberals became Democrats. It was like a rising tide chopped up by 1,000 backward surges. The specialty of the backward surge is to churn things up as it ebbs, hence some very strange combinations of ideas. People worshipped Napoleon and liberty at one and the same time. We are talking about history here. These were the mirages of those bygone days. Opinions go through phases. Voltairean royalism, that bizarre variation, had a counterpart no less strange in Bonapartist liberalism. Other groups of leading lights were more serious. Some sought to define principles, others tackled the law. People were very keen on the absolute, imagining infinite forms it might take. The absolute, by its very rigidity, drives spirits upward into the blue and sets them floating in limitlessness. There is nothing like dogma to spawn dreams, and there is nothing like dreams to generate the future. Utopia today, flesh and blood tomorrow. Advanced opinions, like suitcases, had false bottoms. The mysterious power emerging threatened the established order, which was suspect and sly. This was a sign of revolution in the making, if ever there was one. The ulterior motives of power collide head-on with the ulterior motives of the people who undermine it. The incubation of insurrection is the rejoinder to the premeditated coup d'état. At that time, France still did not have any of those vast underground organizations like the German Tugendbund or the Italian Carbonari, but here and there, obscure underground cells were ramifying. The coup gould started up in Aix. In Paris, among other affiliations of the kind, there was the Society of the Friends of the ABC. What were the Friends of the ABC? A society with the avowed aim of educating children, which, in reality, was designed to rehabilitate men. They declared themselves the Friends of the ABC, of the abaissé, the abased, the downtrodden, the people. They wanted to raise the people up, to set them on their feet. A pun you would be wrong to laugh at. Puns are sometimes serious in politics. Witness the castratus ad castrata
which made Narses an army general. Witness Barbary et Barbarini. Witness Fueros y Fuegos. Witness Tu es Petrus et super hanc Petram, etc., etc. The friends of the ABC were not numerous. It was a secret society at the embryo stage, we would say virtually a clique, if cliques produced heroes. They met in Paris in two places, near Les Halles, in a tavern named Corinth, that comes up again later, and near the Panthéon, in a little café in the Place Saint-Michel named the Café Musain, today demolished. The first of these meeting places was close to the workers, the second to the students. The secret meetings of the Friends of the ABC were normally held in a back room in the Café Musain. This room was fairly removed from the café proper, with which it was connected by a very long corridor, and it had two windows and an exit onto the tiny Rue des Grès via concealed stairs. They would smoke there, have a drink, play cards, have a laugh. They would carry on in very loud voices about everything and in very low voices about everything else. On the wall, an old map of France under the Republic was nailed up, enough of a clue for any passing police officer to smell a rat. Most of the friends of the ABC were students involved in an entente cordiale with a few workers. Here are the names of the main ones. They belong to a certain extent to history. Enjolras, Combeferre, Jean Prouvaire, Feuilly, Courfeyrac, Bahorel, L'Aigle, L-A-S-G-L-E, or L'Aigle, L-A-I-G-L-E, Joly, Grantaire. These young men formed a sort of family among themselves. They were such close friends. All of them, except L'Aigle, were from the south. It was a remarkable group before it vanished into the invisible depths at our backs. At the point we have reached in our tale, it might perhaps be useful to shine a beam of light on those young heads before the reader sees them sink into the shadows of a tragic episode. Enjolras, who comes first on our list, we will see why later, was an only son and rich. Enjolras was a charming young man, capable of being terrifying. He was angelically beautiful. He was Antinous, wild. To see the thoughtful light shining in his eyes, you'd have thought that he had already, in a previous life, lived through the apocalypse of the Revolution. He was familiar with its tradition as though he had been a witness to it. He knew every last detail of the broader canvas. His nature was both pompously dogmatic and warlike, which is strange in an adolescent. He was both officiant, priest, and militant. A soldier of democracy in the immediate term and, above and beyond the contemporary movement, a priest of the ideal. He had deep-set eyes, slightly red eyelids, a thick lower lip that could easily turn disdainful, a high forehead. A lot of forehead in a face is like a lot of sky over a skyline. Like certain young men at the end of last century and the beginning of this, who were illustrious early, he had an excessively youthful look, as fresh as a young girl's, though with moments of pallor. Already a man, he seemed still to be a child. He was 22 years old, but he looked 17. He was grave. He did not seem to know that there was on earth a creature known as woman. He had only one passion, justice, one thought, to overturn all obstacles. On the Aventine Hill, he would have been Gracchus. In the convention, he would have been Saint-Just. He barely saw the roses, ignored the spring, didn't hear the birds sing. Evadne's bare breast would not have moved him any more than Aristogiton. For him, as for Harmodius, flowers were good only for camouflaging swords. He was austere in his pleasures. Before all that was not the Republic, he lowered his eyes chastely. Liberty's marble lover. His words were fiercely inspired and had the trembling note of the hymn about them. He would suddenly spread his wings and take flight when you least expected it. Woe betide anyone who thought they could entice him into some casual fling. Had some grisette from the Place Cambrai or the Rue Saint-Jean de Beauvais clapped eyes on that college escapee face, that page-boy neck, those long blonde eyelashes, those blue eyes, that wild hair flying in the wind, those rosy cheeks, those fresh young lips,
those exquisite teeth, and felt a violent stab of hunger for all that golden glow. And had she been bold enough to try and thrust her beauty on Enjolras, she would have promptly been shot a withering look from out of an unknowable abyss that would have taught her not to confuse the gallant cherubs of Beaumarchais with the awesome cherubim of Ezekiel. Alongside Enjolras, who represented the logic of the revolution, stood Combeferre, who represented its philosophy. Between the logic of the revolution and its philosophy, there is this difference, that its logic can logically lead to war, while its philosophy can only end in peace. Combeferre completed and corrected Enjolras. He was less high-minded and wider-ranging. He wanted them to fill hearts and minds with principles extrapolated into general ideas. He said, revolution, yes, but not without civilization. And all around the mountain peak he opened up the vast blue horizon. This provided an accessible and pragmatic element in all Combeferre's views. The revolution was more breathable with Combeferre than with Enjolras. Enjolras maintained its divine right side, and Combeferre its natural right. The former sided with Robespierre, the latter confined himself to Condorcet. Combeferre lived a much more normal life than Enjolras. If it had been given to these two young men to step onto the stage of history, one would have played the righteous man, the other would have played the sage. Enjolras was more manly. Combeferre was more human. Homo et vir. That was indeed the difference between them. Combeferre was as gentle as Enjolras was severe, from native innocence. He liked the word citizen, but he preferred the word man. He would gladly have said hombre, like the Spanish. He read everything, did the theaters, followed public lectures, learned about the polarization of light from Arago, was widely inspired by a lecture in which Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire explained the twin functions of the external carotid artery and the internal carotid artery, the one supplying the face, the other supplying the brain. He kept abreast of things, followed science every step of the way, compared Saint-Simon with Fourier, deciphered hieroglyphs, broke open any stones he could get his hands on to sift through geology, would draw a silk moth from memory, point out the mistakes in French in the Dictionnaire de l'Académie, studied Puységur and Deleuze, asserted nothing, not even miracles, denied nothing, not even ghosts, flipped through back issues of the Moniteur, daydreamed. He claimed that the future was in the hands of the schoolmaster and got involved in issues of education. He wanted society to work tirelessly at raising intellectual and moral standards, popularizing science, circulating ideas, and cultivating the minds of the young. And he feared that the current impoverishment of the methods employed, the dire narrowness of the teaching of literature, which was limited to two or three centuries said to be classical, the tyrannical dogmatism of the official pedants, scholastic prejudices and routines, would wind up turning our colleges into artificial oyster farms. He was well-read, a purist, precise, polytechnical, hard-working, and at the same time, imaginative to the point of having hallucinations, as his friends like to say. He believed in all these dreams, railroads, the elimination of suffering in surgical operations, the fixing of the image in the camera obscura, the electric telegraph, the use of steering in hot air balloons. On top of this, he was not afraid of all the bulwarks thrown up everywhere you turn by the various forms of superstition, despotism, and prejudice designed to shut out the human race. He was one of those who think that science will wind up turning the tables. Enjolras was a leader, Combeferre was a guide. You would have wanted to fight alongside one and walk alongside the other. It wasn't that Combeferre was not capable of fighting. He did not balk at taking an obstacle in hand-to-hand combat or grabbing it by brute force explosively, but to bring the human race into harmony with its destinies gradually through the teaching of axioms and the promulgation of positive laws was more to his liking. And between two bright lights, he tended toward illumination rather than conflagration. No doubt a raging fire can create light as bright as the light of day. But why not wait for daybreak? A volcano throws light, but sunrise throws even better light.
Combeferre perhaps preferred the white purity of the beautiful to the flaming flash of the sublime. Clarity blurred by smoke, progress bought by violence, only half satisfied this tender and serious spirit. Any headlong plunge by a people into truth, any 93, frightened him, but stagnation revolted him even more. He smelled putrefaction and death in it. All in all, he liked sea spray better than miasma, preferred the torrent to the cesspool, and Niagara Falls to the Lake of Montfaucon. In short, he wanted neither halt nor haste. While his boisterous friends, chivalrously in love with the absolute, worshipped and incited magnificent revolutionary adventures, Combeferre was inclined to let progress take its course. The right sort of progress, which was cool-headed, perhaps, but pure. Methodical but irreproachable. Phlegmatic but imperturbable. Combeferre would have fallen to his knees and prayed if it meant the future would arrive in all its candor, and for nothing to trouble the vast and virtuous evolution of the peoples of the world. Good must be innocent, he never tired of repeating. And, in effect, if the great thing about revolution is that it keeps its eye on the dazzling ideal and flies to it through flashing lightning with fire and blood in its talons, the beauty of progress is to be stainless. And there is between Washington, who represents the former, and Danton, who embodies the latter, the difference that divides the angel with the wings of a swan and the angel with the wings of an eagle. Jean Prouvaire was a tad more mellow than Combeferre. He actually called himself Jean, due to the momentary touch of whimsy that got mixed up in the profound and powerful movement from which that most necessary study of the Middle Ages emerged. Jean Prouvaire was in love, cultivated a flower in a pot, played the flute, wrote poetry, loved the people, pitied womankind, wept for children, confused God and the future in the same trusting attitude, and blamed the revolution for having caused a royal head to roll, that of André Chénier. His voice was usually soft, but would suddenly become manly. He was scholarly to the point of erudition, and almost an orientalist. He was good above all, and in a way that is perfectly straightforward for those who know how closely goodness borders on greatness, he preferred the great in matters of poetry. He was fluent in Italian, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, and this served him to read only four poets, Dante, Juvenal, Aeschylus, and Isaiah. In French, he preferred Corneille to Racine, and Agrippa d'Aubigné to Corneille. He liked to stroll through fields of wild oats and cornflowers, and was almost as involved with clouds as he was with events. His mind had two modes, one to do with man, the other to do with God. He was either studying or meditating. All day long he pored over social questions, wages, capital, credit, marriage, religion, freedom of thought, freedom of choice in love, education, crime and punishment, poverty, freedom of association, property, production, and distribution, the enigma of life here below that casts its shadow over the human anthill. And at night he would gaze at those enormous beings, the stars. Like Enjolras, he was an only son and rich. He spoke softly, cocked his head to one side, kept his eyes downcast, smiled apologetically, dressed badly, looked a little gauche, blushed at nothing, was extremely shy, otherwise fearless. Feuilly was a fan-maker, an orphan on both sides, who worked his fingers to the bone for his 3 francs a day, and whose sole thought was to save the world. He had one other worry, to teach himself, which he also described as saving himself. He had taught himself to read and write. All he knew he had learned on his own. Feuilly was very big-hearted. He had a huge embrace. This orphan had adopted the whole world. Since he lacked a mother, he meditated on the motherland. He did not want there to be a single person on earth without a motherland. With the profound clairvoyance of the man of the people, he nurtured deep within what we now know as the idea of different nationalities. He had learned history for the express purpose of being outraged with good reason. In this inner circle of young utopians, specifically focused on France, he represented the outside world. His specialty was Greece, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Italy. He was always saying those names,
appropriately or inappropriately, with the doggedness of those in the right. The rape of Crete and Thessaly by Turkey, of Warsaw by Russia, of Venice by Austria, these violations infuriated him. The great assault and battery of 1772, when Poland was partitioned, got him going more than anything else. There is no more supreme eloquence than that derived from outrage based on truth. And he was eloquent with that kind of eloquence. He never tired of that infamous date, 1772, of that noble and valiant people put down by treachery, of that crime of three, of that monstrous ambush, the prototype and model of all the shocking acts of state repression committed since that have struck several noble nations and erased the records of their birth, so to speak. All contemporary social acts of terrorism derive from the partition of Poland. The partition of Poland is the theorem of which all current political crimes are the corollaries. There has been no despot, no traitor for what will shortly be a century, who has not initialed, ratified, signed and countersigned, ne variator, the partition of Poland. When you consult the file of modern betrayals, that one appears at the top of the list. The Congress of Vienna consulted this crime before it perpetrated its own. The year 1772 sounds the mort, 1815 gives the hounds their quarry. Such was Feuillet's usual script. This poor working man had made himself the guardian of justice, and justice rewarded him by making him great. The reason is that right is, in fact, indestructible. Warsaw can no more be Tartar than Venice can be Teutonic. Kings waste their time over such matters and lose their honor. Sooner or later, the submerged homeland floats to the surface and reappears. Greece goes back to being Greece. Italy goes back to being Italy. The protest of right against crime goes on forever. The theft of a people has no statutory limit. These top-level swindles have no future. You can't pick the initials off a nation the way you can off a handkerchief. Courfeyrac had a father who was known as Monsieur de Courfeyrac. One of the false ideas the bourgeoisie of the Restoration held about the aristocracy and the nobility was to believe in that particle. The particle, as we know, has no significance. But the bourgeoisie in the days of the Minerve thought so highly of that poor little de that they felt obliged to surrender it. Monsieur de Chauvelin called himself Monsieur Chauvelin. Monsieur de Caumartin, Monsieur Caumartin. Monsieur de Constant de Rebec, Benjamin Constant. Monsieur de Lafayette, Monsieur Lafayette. Courfeyrac did not want to be left behind, so he called himself plain old Courfeyrac. We could almost leave it there as far as Courfeyrac goes, and just say as for the rest, for Courfeyrac, see Tholomyès. Courfeyrac did in fact have that youthful vim we might call the diabolical beauty of wit. Later on, this fades away like the sweetness of a kitten, and all that grace ends on two legs in the bourgeois and on four legs in the tomcat. This kind of wit is transmitted from generation to generation at school in successive levies of young men who pass it along from hand to hand, quasi cursores, more or less exactly the same. So that, as we have just noted, anyone hearing Courfeyrac in 1828 would have thought they were hearing Tholomyès in 1817. Only Courfeyrac was a good lad. Beneath the apparent outward similarities of wit, there was a huge difference between him and Tholomyès. The latent man that existed in each was altogether different. In Tholomyès, there was a prosecutor, and in Courfeyrac, a paladin. Enjolras was the leader, Combeferre the guide, and Courfeyrac the center. The others gave out more light, he gave out more heat. The fact is, he had all the properties of a center, being round and radiant. Bahorel had featured in the bloody tumult of June 1822 on the occasion of the funeral of the young student Lallemand. Bahorel was the man to see for good humor and bad company. He was brave, hopeless with money, profligate verging on generous, chatty verging on eloquent, bold verging on provocative. He was the best bastard that ever there was. He wore loud waistcoats and flaming red opinions to match. He was a great one for noise, which is to say, he liked nothing more than a good brawl except a riot, and nothing more than a riot except a revolution. Always ready to throw a cobblestone through a window, then to tear up the whole street, then to tear down a government, just to see the effect. A student of the nursery school, always playing up. He sniffed around the law for a bit, but he never did it. He had taken as his motto, "Never a lawyer be," and for his coat of arms, a night table on which a square cap might be glimpsed. Every time he went past the law school, which was rarely, he would button up his redding coat, the short jacket known as a palto not having been invented yet, and he would take hygienic precautions. He said of the school portal, "What a fine old man!" And of the dean, Monsieur d'Avincourt, "What a monument!" For him, his courses were mere subjects for ditties, and his professors opportunities for caricatures. He ate up a fairly large allowance, something like 3,000 francs, doing nothing. His parents were peasants he'd managed to teach to respect their son. He used to say of them, "They're peasants, not bourgeois. That's why they're smart." Bahorel was a capricious man, and spread himself thin over several cafés. The others had habits, he had none. He strolled. To err is human, to stroll, Parisian. At bottom, a penetrating mind, and more of a thinker than he let on. He served as the connection between the friends of the ABC and other groups that were still nebulous then, but would later take shape. There was one bald member of this conclave of young heads, the Marquis d'Avaray, whom Louis XVIII had made a duke for having helped him to get up into a hackney cab the day he emigrated, told how in 1814, on his return to France, the king disembarked at Calais, and a man presented him with a petition. "What are you after?" asked the king. "Sire, a post office." "What's your name?" "L'Aigle." "The Eagle." The king frowned, looked at the signature on the petition, and saw the name written L-E-S-G-L-E. This spelling, which was anything but Bonapartist, touched the king, and he cracked a smile. "Sire," the man with the petition went on, "my grandfather was a whipper-in, a dog man, nicknamed Le Gueule, Muzzles. That nickname became my name. I'm known as Le Gueule. L'Aigle, L-A-S-G-L-E, by contraction, and L'Aigle, L-A-I-G-L-E, by corruption." This put the smile back on the king's face. Later on, he gave the man the post office at Meaux, M-E-A-U-X. Meaux, M-O-T-S, either by accident or design. The bald member of the group was the son of this L'Aigle, or L'Aigle, and signed his name L'Aigle de Meaux. His friends shortened this to Bossuet. Bossuet was a cheery boy who had bad luck. His specialty was not to succeed at anything. On the other hand, he laughed at everything. At 25, he was as bald as a badger. His father had wound up with a house and a field, but he, the son, had wasted no time losing said house and field in a dodgy speculation. He had nothing left. He had erudition and wit, but he always misfired. Everything came to nothing on him. Everything failed him. Whatever he tried to achieve came crashing down on his head. If he tried to chop wood, he cut his finger. If he found a mistress, he very soon discovered he had also found a new male friend. At any given moment, some mishap would befall him, hence his joviality. He would say, "I live under a roof of falling tiles." Nothing surprised him, for accidents were only to be expected, as far as he was concerned. He took bad luck in his stride and smiled at fate's taunts as though they were terrific jokes. He was poor, but his fund of good humor was inexhaustible. He was very soon down to his last sou, never to his last laugh. When adversity came calling, he cordially greeted that old acquaintance. He was on very good terms with catastrophe. He was so familiar with the twist of fate that he called it by a nickname. "Hello, you old spoilsport," he would say. The relentless persecution by fate had made him inventive. He was endlessly resourceful. He had no money, but whenever the fancy took him, he always found the means to damn the expense. One night he went so far as to gobble up 100 francs dining with some scatterbrain, which inspired him to utter this memorable phrase in the middle of his orgy, "5 gold louis, woman, pull off my boots."
Bossuet was slowly making his way toward the legal profession. He did his law in the manner of Bahorel. Bossuet didn't have much of a roof over his head, at times none at all. He would camp for a while at one person's place, then at someone else's, most often at Joly's. Joly was studying medicine. He was 2 years younger than Bossuet. Joly was the malade imaginaire, the imaginary invalid as a young man. What he had got out of medicine had made him more of an invalid than a doctor. At 23, he believed himself to be chronically ill and spent his life looking at his tongue in the mirror. He asserted that man was magnetized like the needle of a compass, and in his room he positioned his bed with the head facing south and the foot facing north, so that at night the circulation of his blood would not be impeded by the great magnetic current between the two poles of the globe. In stormy weather he would take his pulse. Otherwise, he was the cheeriest of the lot. All these inconsistencies, being young, fastidious, hypochondriacal, full of life, got on very well together, and produced an eccentric and likable person that his cronies, always free with winged consonants, called Joly. "You can take off with four L's," Jean Prouvaire told him. Joly was in the habit of rubbing his nose with the end of his cane, which is a sure sign of a sagacious mind. All these young men, so diverse, and of whom, when it comes down to it, we should only speak seriously, shared the same religion, progress. All were the direct descendants of the French Revolution. The most light-hearted became solemn in pronouncing that date, 1789. Their flesh and blood fathers were, or had been, Fouillons, royalists, doctrinaires. It didn't matter much. This mishmash that came before them, the young, did not concern them. The blue blood of principles ran in their veins. They were directly related, without any intermediary link, to incorruptible right and absolute duty. Associates and initiates, they drafted the ideal together in secret. Among all these passionate hotheads and true believers, there was one skeptic. How did he get to be there? By juxtaposition. This skeptic's name was Grantaire, and he normally signed with this rebus, R, for Grantaire, capital R. Grantaire was a man who took good care not to believe in anything, and he was one of the students who had got the most out of his studies in Paris. He knew that the best coffee was in the Café Lemblin, and that the best billiard table was in the Café Voltaire, that you got good cakes and good girls at L'Hermitage on the Boulevard du Maine, spatchcock chickens at Mother Sarguet's, excellent fish stews at the Barrière de la Cunette, and a certain light white wine at the Barrière du Combat. For everything, he knew all the best places. He also knew how to kickbox and make his way around a gymnasium and a dance floor. And he was a natural with a single stick in stick fighting, a big drinker to boot, and unnaturally ugly. The prettiest boot-stitcher of the day, Irma Boissy, appalled by his ugliness, had come out with this sentence, "Grantaire is impossible." But Grantaire was so conceited he was not at all put off by this. He looked on all women tenderly and staringly, with an air of saying of all of them, "If I wanted to," and hoping to persuade his friends that he was in general demand. All these words, the right of the people, the rights of man, the social contract, the French Revolution, republic, democracy, humanity, civilization, religion, progress, were, for Grantaire, very close to being completely meaningless. He smiled at them. Skepticism, that dry rot of the intellect, had not left one intact idea in his head. He thrived on irony. This was his axiom: there is only one certainty, my full glass. He derided any allegiance to any party, in the brother as much as in the father, in the young Robespierre as much as in Loiserolles. "A fat lot of good it did them, dying," he would cry. He said of the crucifix, "Now there's a gibbet that worked." Womanizer, gambler, lecher, often drunk, he riled those young dreamers by endlessly crooning, "I loves the girls and I loves good wine," to the tune of "Long Live Henri IV." Still, this skeptic was fanatical about one thing. This one thing he was fanatical about was neither an idea nor a dogma, neither an art nor a science. It was a man, Enjolras.
Grantaire admired, loved, and venerated Enjolras. Who did this anarchic doubter rally to in this phalanx of absolutists? To the most absolute. In what way did Enjolras enthrall him? Through ideas? No. Through character. A phenomenon frequently observed. A skeptic sticking to a believer, it is as elementary as the law of complementary colors. What we lack attracts us. No one loves daylight more than the blind. The dwarf adores the drum major. The toad always has his eyes on the heavens. Why? To see the birds fly. Grantaire, in whom doubt lurked, loved to see faith soar in Enjolras. He needed Enjolras without really realizing it and without trying to explain it to himself. He was held spellbound by that chaste, healthy, firm, upright, hard, candid character. He admired instinctively his opposite. His limp, wavering, disjointed, sick, deformed ideas attached themselves to Enjolras as to a backbone. His moral spine leaned on that firm frame. Beside Enjolras, Grantaire became somebody again. He was himself, in any case, composed of two apparently incompatible elements. He was ironic and warm-hearted. His indifference was loving. His mind dispensed with faith, but his heart could not dispense with friendship. A profound contradiction, for an affection is a conviction. That was his nature. Some men seem born to be the verso, the reverse, the wrong side. They are Pollux, Patroclus, Nisus, Eudamidus, Hephaestion, Pemeja. They can live only on condition of leaning on someone else. Their name is a sequel and can only be written preceded by the conjunction and. Their existence is not their own. It is the other side of a destiny that is not theirs. Grantaire was one of these men. He was the wrong side of Enjolras. We could almost say that affinities begin with the letters of the alphabet. In the series, O and P are inseparable. You can say O and P or Orestes and Pylades, whichever you prefer. Grantaire, as a true satellite of Enjolras, dwelt in this circle of young men. He lived there. He was only happy there. He followed them everywhere. His great delight was to see those silhouettes coming and going in the haze of wine. They put up with him because of his good humor. The believer in Enjolras looked down on the skeptic, and the teetotaler looked down on the drunk. He would dole out a dose of pity from on high. Grantaire was a Pylades who did not pass muster. Always treated roughly by Enjolras, pushed away harshly, rejected, yet coming back for more, he would say of Enjolras, "Such a beautiful slab of marble." Blondeau's Funeral Oration by Bossuet. One particular afternoon, that, as we are about to see, roughly coincided with the events related above, L'Aigle de Meaux was leaning back sensually in the doorway of the Café Musain. He looked like a caryatid on holiday, holding up nothing more than his reverie. He was watching the Place Saint-Michel. Leaning back on something is a way of lying down, standing up, that dreamers don't mind at all. L'Aigle de Meaux was thinking, not too sorrowfully, of a bit of a mishap that had befallen him 2 days before at law school, and that changed his personal plans for the future, plans that were, in any case, fairly vague. Reverie does not stop a cabriolet from passing or the dreamer from noticing this cabriolet. L'Aigle de Meaux's eyes were wandering in a sort of leisurely stroll, and he saw, through the haze of his somnambulism, a two-wheeled vehicle making its way around the square at a very slow trot, as though unsure where it was going. Who was this cabriolet after? Why was it going at such a slow trot? L'Aigle looked at it. Inside, next to the driver, there was a young man, and in front of this young man, there was a fairly big overnight bag. The bag revealed to bystanders this name, written in big black letters on a card sewed to the material. Marius Pontmercy. The name made L'Aigle shift position. He straightened up and called out to the young man in the cabriolet, "Monsieur Marius Pontmercy!" The cabriolet, thus hailed, stopped. The young man, who also seemed deeply lost in thought, raised his eyes. "Pardon?" he said.
You are Monsieur Marius Pontmercy?
I am.
I've been looking for you, said L'Aigle de Meaux.
How come? Asked Marius, for it was he, in fact, fresh from his grandfather's, and setting eyes on this figure before him for the first time in his life.
I don't know you. I don't know you either, answered L'Aigle.
Marius thought he'd run into a funny man, and that some sort of practical joke was being played in the middle of the street. He was not in a joking mood just then. He frowned. The unflappable L'Aigle de Meaux went on.
Weren't you at school the day before yesterday?
It's possible.
It's a fact. Are you a student? Asked Marius. Yes, monsieur, like you. The day before yesterday, I just happened to turn up at school. You know how it is. You sometimes get these funny ideas. The professor was calling the roll. You're well aware how ridiculous they are about roll call. If you miss three calls, they take your name off the roll. 60 francs down the drain.
Marius started to listen. L'Aigle continued.
It was Blondeau who was calling the roll. You know Blondeau, he's the one with the very pointy, very spiteful nose who loves sniffing our absentees. He cunningly began with the letter P. I wasn't listening, not being implicated in that particular letter. The roll call wasn't going too badly. No one was struck off. Every man and his dog was present. Blondeau was disappointed. I said to myself, Blondeau, my love, you won't have even a hint of an execution today. Suddenly Blondeau calls out, Marius Pontmercy. No one answers. Blondeau gets his hopes up and repeats louder, Marius Pontmercy. And he grabs his pen. Monsieur, I'm not heartless. I swiftly told myself, here's a brave lad who's about to be struck off. Careful, this one's a real live human being who is not punctual. This one's not a good boy. This is not some fat-arsed bookworm, a student who actually studies, some pimply pedant, strong in science, literature, theology, and sapience, one of those ninnies dressed to the nines with a different outfit for each faculty. He's an honorable bludger who's ambling about the place somewhere, busy being on holidays, cultivating grisettes, courting beauties who may perhaps at this very instant be with my mistress at her place. Let's save him. Death to Blondeau. At that moment, Blondeau dipped his pen, black with crossings out, in the ink, gave his audience the once-over with his cat-like eyes, and repeated for the third time, Marius Pontmercy. I answered, present. And that means you are not struck off.
Monsieur, said Marius,
and that I was, added L'Aigle de Meaux.
I don't understand, said Marius.
L'Aigle resumed, nothing simpler. I stood next to the rostrum to answer and next to the door to make my escape. The professor gave me a pretty steady stare. He'd have to be the cunning nose Boileau talks about, because suddenly Blondeau jumps to the letter L. L, that's my letter. I am from Meaux, and my name's L'Aigle.
L'Aigle, Marius interrupted. What a beautiful name.
Monsieur, old Blondeau gets to that beautiful name and cries, L'Aigle. I answer, present. So then Blondeau looks at me with the sweet smile of a tiger, and he says, if you are Pontmercy, you are not L'Aigle. A phrase that seems a bit insulting to you, but it was sinister only to me. And without further ado, he strikes me off.
Marius exclaimed,
Monsieur, I'm mortified. Before anything else, L'Aigle broke in, I ask to embalm Blondeau with a few phrases of heartfelt praise. I'm assuming he's dead. That wouldn't be much of a change. He's so skinny and pale and cold and stiff and smelly. And I say, Erudimini qui judicatis terram. Here lies Blondeau, Blondeau the nose. Blondeau Nasica, the bullock of discipline, bos disciplinae, the great watchdog of order, the angel of roll call, who was straight, square, punctual, rigid, honest, and awful. God struck him off, just as he struck me off.
Marius went on.
I am so sorry. Young man, said L'Aigle de Meaux, let this be a lesson to you, in future beyond time. I am truly sorry. Never expose yourself again to having your fellow man struck off.
I don't know what I can do, L'Aigle burst out laughing.
I do. I'm thrilled. I was on the brink of becoming a lawyer. This being crossed out saves me. I renounce the triumphs of the bar. I will not defend the widow, nor will I attack the orphan. No more robe, no more professional training. My crossing out has already been achieved. I owe this to you, Monsieur Pontmercy. I intend to pay you a solemn visit of thanks. Where do you live?
In a cabriolet, said Marius.
A sure sign of opulence. L'Aigle calmly shot back. I congratulate you. You have there a rent of 9,000 francs a year.
At that moment, Courfeyrac came out of the café.
Marius continued sadly, I've been paying that rent
for 2 hours now, and I hope to get out of it, but it's the usual story. I don't know where to go.
Monsieur, said Courfeyrac, come home with me.
I should have priority, observed Legler, but I don't have a home to go to.
Shut up, Bossuet, Courfeyrac went on.
Bossuet, said Marius, but I thought you said your name was Legler.
De Meaux, replied Legler. Bossuet, metaphorically speaking.
Courfeyrac climbed up into the cabriolet.
Driver, he said, Hôtel de la Porte Saint-Jacques.
And that very evening, Marius was installed at the Hôtel de la Porte Saint-Jacques in a room right alongside Courfeyrac.
The amazement of Marius. In a few days, Marius was friends with Courfeyrac. Youth is the season when bones are swiftly mended and wounds rapidly healed. Marius breathed freely by Courfeyrac's side, a fairly new sensation for him. Courfeyrac did not ask him any questions. He did not even think to. At that age, faces say it all right away. Words are pointless. There is a kind of young man you could describe as having a face that talks. One look, and you know each other. One morning, though, Courfeyrac suddenly shot him this question. By the way, do you have any political views?
Really? Said Marius, almost offended by the question.
What are you?
A Bonapartist Democrat.
Ah, a nice grey shade of mousy, said Courfeyrac.
The next day Courfeyrac introduced Marius to the Café Musain. Then he whispered in his ear with a smile, I must gain your admission to the revolution. And he took him to the room of the Friends of the ABC. He introduced him to the other comrades, adding, in an undertone, this simple word that Marius did not quite get. A novice. Marius had fallen into a mental hornet's nest. But although quiet and grave, he was just as quick on his feet and just as ready to sting as the best of them. Till then solitary and given to monologues and private asides out of habit and inclination, Marius was a bit scared by this flock of young men flapping all around him. All these diverse initiatives demanded his attention and pulled him in all directions at once. The tumultuous give and take of all these minds at liberty and at work set his ideas in a whirl. Sometimes, in the confusion, they floated off so far away from him that he had trouble catching up with them again. He heard talk of philosophy, literature, art, history, religion, in the most unexpected ways. He glimpsed things from strange angles, and, as he could not put them into perspective, he wasn't sure whether he wasn't looking at chaos. In shrugging off the opinions of his grandfather to don the opinions of his father, he thought he was set. He now suspected, anxiously and without daring to admit it to himself, that he was not. The point from which he viewed all things was shifting once more. A certain oscillation was shaking up all the horizons of his brain. A bizarre inner commotion. It almost hurt him physically. It looked like nothing was sacred to these young men. Marius had to listen to the most peculiar talk on every issue, and this upset his still timid mind. A theater poster turned up, emblazoned with the title of a tragedy from the old so-called classical repertoire. Down with tragedy, so dear to the bourgeois, yelled Bahorel. And Marius heard Combeferre reply, You're wrong, Bahorel. The bourgeoisie love tragedy, and they should be left alone on that score. The wigged tragedy has its raison d'être, and far be it from me to challenge its right to exist, as some do, in the name of Aeschylus. There are rough drafts in nature, there are in creation ready-made parodies. A beak that is not a beak, wings that aren't wings, fins that aren't fins, paws that aren't paws, a cry of pain that makes you want to laugh. There you have the duck in a nutshell. Now, since the domestic fowl exists alongside the bird, I can't see why classical tragedy should not exist in the face of antique tragedy.
Another time, Marius happened to be going down the Rue Jean-Jacques Rousseau between Enjolras and Courfeyrac. Courfeyrac took his arm. Be careful. This is the Rue Plâtrière, now called the Rue Jean-Jacques Rousseau because of an odd couple that lived here about 60 years ago. That was Jean-Jacques and Thérèse. From time to time, little creatures would be born there. Thérèse brought them into the world, Jean-Jacques booted them out into the world. Enjolras then savaged Courfeyrac.
Silence in front of Jean-Jacques! I admire the man. He disowned his own